Okay, good evening. Welcome. How's everyone? Can everyone hear me? Okay, just had a little technical problem. Of course we did. My name is Stacy Dexter, and I am part of the Gloucester Writers Center Education Committee. It's heartwarming to see such a remarkable turnout tonight. Our very special guest, Anita Diamond, here tonight. This not only does the Gloucester Writers Center appreciate having everyone here gathered together, but especially so many readers. Really glad to see so many readers, and we want to acknowledge and thank everyone for being so gracious about having to reschedule. Our sincerest condolences to you. We're thrilled to have you here with us, and we look forward to your talk tonight. So how many of you are in a book club? No, can I hear how many of you are in a book club? All right, there we go. So when Dan Duffy, who is current president of the Gloucester Writers Center Executive Board, had an idea for this concept of a Meet the Author night, I figured, that he'd start small, book a local author with a modest following, have a few cocktails, a reading, and that would be the beginning of what we would hope to grow in the future. However, when Dan told us that he had contacted Anita Diamond and was crossing his fingers for a response, I thought, wow, that's pretty ambitious. I'm like, good luck. Yes, okay. We better look into something else. But when she said yes, which we are so grateful, I asked Dan, why Anita? Why did you? That was his go-to person immediately. He didn't have to think about it. He said, this is the person I want. So this is a quote from Dan. When the idea of sponsoring a Gloucester Writers Center Meet the Author Night came up in an education committee meeting, I immediately thought of the author Anita Diamond. I had read her book, The Last Days of Dogtown. Anyone else here read that book? It's a great book. He had attended a reading at the KPM Museum a few years ago, and he was very impressed. So he went on to investigate several of her best-selling books like Good Harbor, The Boston Girl, right? And he was struck by her use of our area in her novels. He's originally from New Jersey, and he had not been aware that someone was using his new hometown as the backdrop to so many of her books. So he thought, what a better way to kick off the Education Initiative series with someone like Anita with ties to Cape Ann. And I think we can all agree that this was an exceptional idea. So thank you, Dan. I'm almost done. So I'm going to give you a little background on Anita and then let her get up here. So Anita Diamond is the author of 12 books. Her first novel, the New York Times bestseller, The Red Tent, has been published in more than 25 countries. If you haven't read this book, it's a must read. It was the winner, yes, The Red Tent, absolutely. It was the winner of the 2001 Book Sense Book of the Year Award, and it was also adapted into a two-part miniseries by Lifetime Television. It's very nice. Anita is also one of the most respected writers of guides to contemporary Jewish life. She has written 6 nonfiction guides on this topic, including a recent revision of one of her most popular books, The Jewish Wedding, retitled to The Jewish Wedding Now. I'm sure it's changed a lot. Her journalistic work has been published in countless magazines, and a collection of her essays, Pitching My Tent, is drawn from 20 years worth of newspaper and magazine columns. Anita graduated from Washington University in St. Louis with a degree in comparative literature and holds a master's degree in English from Brigham University. Beautiful and educated. This is good. She currently resides in the Boston area with her husband, Jim Ball. So Dan really stuck gold. He really struck gold when Anita said yes to our proposal. We are so fortunate and grateful to have her with us tonight. She is not only a talented and successful writer, she is also a strong female voice for our times. It is my pleasure and honor to introduce one of my favorite writers, and obviously yours, Miss Anita Diamond.
lot to live up to. Why wouldn't I say yes? I mean, this is, I don't live here all the time, but I consider this home as well. And so when my local library asks me to do something, or my local community center asks me to do something, I tend to say yes. So I love it here. So I'm going to talk this evening about finding Cape Ann and how it fits into my life and how it's also found expression in what I've written.
You just might have to stand up.
Oh, no, you're not there.
There you go.
Okay.
Can
you hear me? If you can't hear me in the back, just hold up a hand, okay? Okay. It's kind of hard when you're reading. Okay. So, I did not grow up loving the ocean or the beach or the sea. I was raised in New Jersey, and to immigrant parents, we did not go to the beach a whole lot. And then we moved to Denver, Colorado, where there was no beach, and I did fall in love with the mountains. I found myself, after college and graduate school, I moved to the Boston area because I had friends here, mostly. And while I was living in a group house, one of my housemates rented a place on Martha's Vineyard for a week, and that was my introduction, really, to the seaside in New England and Massachusetts. And I had a great time. I didn't fall in love with it. If you've ever been to State Beach, it's kind of flat and boring, and I didn't understand the romance of the ocean. I really didn't. It took me a long time, and I think there's something meditative about the ocean, and you really have to sit still and listen to it and watch it for a long time. For me, it took a long time, and not just the big crashing waves, but just the vast expanse of it. I did bring my daughter there as a baby. She's now 32 in a couple of weeks. And we went to Martha's Vineyard for a week every summer for 5 years, 6 years. But then she started school, and Martha's Vineyard was just too expensive. I just couldn't go there anymore. One of my neighbors grew up in Peabody and spent his summers walking Good Harbor Beach. And so we started coming up to the beach with them. They had a daughter exactly my daughter's age. They were going to school together. And we drove up every Saturday and every Sunday back and forth to Newton whenever the weather permitted, and spent the day at Good Harbor Beach. We were sponsored as members of the beach club, the Bass Rocks Beach Club, which is one of my homes away from home, where my daughter learned to swim. And Good Harbor Beach became my special place. It's still a place where if I can't fall asleep, I close my eyes and think about it. If I'm agitated, I try to think about that place. I don't know how many miles I have clocked back and forth. I don't know how many conversations I've clocked back and forth. It's been a place where, I'm not sure that inspiration is the right word, but I've worked out what my next book project might be or what my next column might be. So it's very special, and we rented places for a while, for a week here and a week there, and eventually we rented a place. I'm trying to remember the year. It was probably 96 or 97. We were renting a place on Rocky Neck. That was the year that the thing collapsed.
The
West Wharf collapsed. We were staying right next to it, and the West Wharf collapsed. Was it 96?
96.
And that was the year I finished. Right next to us, and we watched people get rescued, and only a rabbit died.
Yes.
In that. Is that right? Is that right? There was a rabbit.
But it was my friend's rabbit.
Oh, I'm sorry. that's the nice thing about small towns, right? Somebody knew the rabbit. Oh, yes. But the cats and dogs were rescued, I want to say. Anyway,
yes.
Anyway, I had been working on a novel. That was my first novel. I was working on a book that on my computer was called The Book of Dina, which turned into The Red Tent. So I finished writing it on Rocky Neck, actually. And then I tried to sell it, which took a while. But in the process of working on the book and writing and walking more because I couldn't figure out what to do next, and because, as one of my editors said, I was sitting on my brains, so you take a walk. And I started to get, it took a minute, didn't it? So I got to know Gloucester a little bit, and I started exploring Cape Ann in the process of coming up here with my daughter and my husband and friends, and went to Halibut Point for the first time and wandered in the Cape Ann Museum and walked up and down the streets in East Gloucester. It's Pleasant Street, that's right across from the theater.
Mount Pleasant,
where I became acquainted with a very beautiful Madonna, who's about this big, who found her way. Not in the bathtub, actually.
Oh.
She's a freestanding, beautiful statue. Anyway, so Cape Ann was embedding itself in my imagination all that time. And up on Mount Pleasant Street, there was that Madonna, and she found her way into my second novel, which is Good Harbor. Good Harbor Beach is the setting for a lot of conversation in Good Harbor. That was my second novel. So The Red Tent turned out to be, after a slow start, thanks to book groups, a bestseller. Thank you. You put my daughter through college. And you bought me a little house up here, too. So Good Harbor was my second novel. It was about as different as it could possibly be from The Red Tent, which is this sort of epic, ancient, nobody could tell me that I got the recipe for goat stew wrong because I could make it up, as long as I didn't have anything that was an anachronism, so there's no tomatoes in it. So Good Harbor is a contemporary novel, completely different, very small, set over the course of one summer on Cape Ann, and it tells the story of a developing relationship between two friends. And the beach in that book, Good Harbor Beach, is kind of a character as well. And the two main characters, Kathleen and Joyce, spend a lot of time on the beach, walking and talking. I'm going to read you just a little bit. So this is from the point of view of Kathleen. On Sunday, Buddy, so her husband, suggested a walk at Good Harbor. As they crossed the wooden footbridge at the southern edge of the beach, Kathleen reminded herself to look. This place was so familiar to her that she sometimes walked halfway across before lifting her eyes to see the day's singular display of cloud and surf. Not even a mile from end to end at low tide, the graceful sweep of Good Harbor was her elixir, her secret potion. When she dreamed about Good Harbor, she woke up refreshed. Today the water was as flat as a pond out to the horizon, but Kathleen had seen plenty of angry seas with 6-foot swells here too. She and Pat had walked the length of Good Harbor thousands of times, back and forth, sometimes 6 lengths at a go, talking nonstop. Buddy called it chewing the fat. "You two get all the flavor out?" he'd ask when they finally sat down for a picnic with him and the boys. The sisters had remained close, even after Pat had entered the convent and Kathleen had started her marriage and family, a Jewish family at that. They called each other every week, and when Pat came to visit, they never stopped talking. Buddy took her hand as they started down toward the water's edge. Kathleen hadn't talked to anyone like that since Pat had died. So Good Harbor Beach, there is the setting for memory and joy and sorrow all at the same time. So she makes friends. Kathleen is in her late 50s, early 60s, and she makes friend with a much younger woman, sort of by accident. And this is Joyce. And Kathleen has taken her out to Salt Island for the first time. They've climbed all the way to the top, and Joyce was very afraid. She was not a climber. But they got to the top, and now she's looking out at the beach. Joyce shaded her eyes and moved slowly like a searchlight, taking in the panorama of Good Harbor. The tidal river was gone, and the footbridge looked like a Japanese miniature. The salt marsh glittered bottled green in the late light, while oblivious drivers sped through the deepening sky, heading home for supper. She turned. The balconies of the Red Motel were deserted, but next door a fortunate few sat in proprietary silence on the decks of houses perched above the private stretch of the beach. Joyce imagined their vista focused on Thatcher Island and its twin lighthouses. She turned again to scan the broad arc of dark ocean, 180 degrees of sky-skimmed water, full and empty, blue on blue, cool and far. Joyce felt dizzy, a momentary champagne kind of dizzy. She looked to landfall at the rocky stretch below Atlantic Avenue, where the bass rocks wore their customary mantle of gulls and cormorants, prehistoric birds drying their mangy-looking wings in the breeze. Joyce strained to memorize the colors, the specific shape of rock, roof, breaker, and beak bathed in this light. She faced the mansion on the bluff, a boxy Yankee castle that inspired fantasies of wealth in everyone who walked Good Harbor. Funny how it was not so grand from here, swallowed by the tree-covered hills above and behind. Next time, she would bring binoculars. That's Good Harbor. It was fun when I was touring with this book, and people were surprised that there was actually a real place called Good Harbor Beach. But there were always a handful of people in the audience, no matter where I was, who were saying, no, it's real. It's real. It's really, really, really a place. So I finished Good Harbor Beach actually in a cabin in Rockport that I rented from a friend on the little pond across from the cemetery. So in a little tiny house. And so I finished that book there. Last Days of Dogtown, my third novel, was inspired by a pamphlet I got at the bookstore on Main Street here. And the pamphlet is called Dogtown, A Village Lost in Time. And I couldn't find that one. It's in a file someplace. But it was really intriguing. It had these little thumbnail sketches of the characters who were said to be some of the last people were some of the early settlers up there. And they had such great names. Naming characters in books can be tough. But here were these names. Easter Carter, who was an informal kind of innkeeper. Old Ruth, who was an African, freed African, to whom she belonged, I cannot make out, said somebody. She also wore men's clothing, and she built stone walls, and she used the name John Woodman. Great, right there. Tammy Younger, who's a horrible old woman, who everyone thought was a witch. She sounded truly nasty. And then Black Neil, who was the last inhabitant, supposedly, of Dogtown. His real name was Cornelius Finson. He was a freed African. He was literate. He was a clerk for Fishers in Annisquam. And he was known to be friendly with Judy Rhines, who in the novel is sort of the main character, the heart of the book. So I was doing the research for Dogtown, and I went to the library. I went to the, to the library here in Gloucester. I went to the Cape Ann Historical Society, and I went to the Cape Ann Museum's library, and everybody was extremely helpful. And so I kept looking for material about Dogtown. And there wasn't a lot, but everybody referred to the same source material. This. It was in the Cape Ann Library, and it was also the source material for those thumbnail sketches in the pamphlet. And for every book that is written that has a chapter on Dogtown basically refers to this book by Charles E. Mann. It was published here in 1896, and it's the story of Dogtown, it's called. It was fascinating. I had to have my own copy, so Amazon, $20. And it's falling apart. I need to do something about this. The stories that I fleshed out in here, wait a minute, I'm getting lost. So Charles Mann wrote these stories about the characters. This is not a reliable source. He gives Neil Finson's death at two different dates. And at the beginning of the book, he actually says, these are stories told to me by white-haired men and women, remembering what their grandparents had told them at the fireside. So this was rumors and innuendo and memories that were embroidered. So there is really no good, solid source material about Dogtown. But that's great for novelists because you just can run with it. But there were these stories, and I do believe, and there are people with these names, and the name, some of the names have persisted on Cape Ann over the years. So I had a lot of freedom to embroider, and actually when I was looking through this again, I realized that I did base a lot of the character studies and also the relationships on hints in this book. The setting of Dogtown is as much a character in the book as this handful of poor, strange people who are the kinds of people who about whom history is not written, illiterate for the most part, very poor, living in rural America. And it was a harsh place, Dogtown. It was far away, especially in the winter. Can you imagine trying to get there and back on a very cold day over those rocky roads? So I'm going to read you just the beginning of the book, where from the perspective of Judy Rhines, who, as I said, was sort of the heart and soul of the book. Okay,
down.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. Okay. So.
Just don't want to miss the word.
Oh yeah, precious, precious words. Okay. Judy Rhines decided to take the footpath through the pasture. It was half the distance of walking all the way down the Commons Road and back up Dogtown Road, and she wanted to get there early enough to be of help. But the going was slow. The winter of 1814 had buckled the field with frost, and there was black ice in every hollow. If she didn't consider every step, she might end up as bad off as Abraham Worf, who certainly had no need of her hurry. The cold seemed to add hours and miles to even the shortest journey through Dogtown. Gloucester, which was barely an hour's walk for a healthy man in good weather, could seem as remote as Salem in February. It was a gloomy landscape, even on a fine day, with its rutted thoroughfares and ruined houses, and the odd collection of souls who had washed up into the rocky hills of Cape Ann. At least it wasn't windy, Judy consoled herself. And that's where it starts. It starts with this very freezing cold place. I remember being up here working on this book and lying in bed in my little Rockport house, which had heat, trying to imagine people living in cabins with chinks in the walls and just with nothing but a blanket in weather like that, or a banked fire, or a dog to keep you warm, in fact. So as you can see from these two descriptions, the landscape it's not described from on high from an omniscient narrator, really. All my books are very character driven, so they're described by these different characters, and it's their point of view that you see the landscape through. This is especially true in Boston Girl, which is my most recent novel, which isn't so new anymore. But I gotta tell you, I signed a contract for a book called Rockport Lodge. This was going to be a very different book when I started out. Rockport Lodge, as you know, is on South Street. It still has the sign above the door, which they repainted recently, which I think I had something to do with. But it was a farmhouse that had been turned into a lodge for young ladies in 1906, I believe it opened. And I had passed it a million times driving around here. And then one day I was driving by, and a friend of mine walked out the front door, so I pulled over and she was a cook, and she was there for the summer as the cook. And she told me it was for women only, and I had no idea. And it had been for women only since its founding. So I was fascinated by that, so I sort of filed it away in the back of my mind. And then I watched Rockport Lodge fall apart, as many of us did. It got shabbier and shabbier. Weeds started sprouting from the gutters, and then one summer, the lights never went on again. And I don't know if you know the history of that. There was talk about turning it into housing for women who needed housing, and the neighborhood said no. So it got sold, and the money then went to support women and children in need. But it is now back to being a private home. It doesn't look like it used to when I'm describing it in the book. It's got an open floor plan. It's very beautiful, and a granite kitchen. So it's not the same place at all. But what I thought I would do was tell the story of Rockport Lodge through a group of friends who went there from early in its history to its closing, sort of same time next year kind of thing. Those of you who remember the play and the movie, I can't say that among a very young audience. They have no idea what I'm talking about. But it's that return to the... Yeah, yes. to this motel, this couple who have an adulterous relationship, and every summer they tell their spouses they're on retreat, I think, and religious retreat, and they have this this long-standing affair. But year after year, and you watch them age and change. So I thought I would do that with Rockport Lodge, and I started doing research, and I just fell in love with the 20s I gotta say. So the book begins in 1915. It's a first-person account told by Addie Baum, who's the daughter of immigrants, who comes to Rockport Lodge when she's 15 years old, and it completely changes her view of the world and everything she understands about herself and the world she lives in. It's about the magic that a place and that a chance encounter with a new place can change the way you view the whole world. So for Addie and the girls around her, it was their first time to experience their own bed, their own pillow. These were poor girls from a very poor neighborhood in the north end of Boston, which at the time was one of the worst tenements in the United States. And she picked up her head and she saw the natural world for the first time. So I'm going to read you a little bit of what Addie saw when she came here. Let's see. Okay. So Addie Baum is telling the story of her life to her granddaughter, Ava. So it's a very warm kind of encounter. She's not telling it into the ether. She's telling it to someone she loves. So, I'll never forget when I took your mother to see The Wizard of Oz. You know the scene when everything changes from black and white to color? That's what it felt like the first time I went to Rockport. Everything was in color. Everything was new. Even things I'd seen my whole life. The ocean, for example. Boston Harbor was a few blocks from where I grew up. And sure, the water there was filthy and the docks were smelly and dangerous. But how could I not know about low tide and high tide? I had never seen a cloud change the color of the sea in a second, or heard water crashing so loud you couldn't hear the person standing next to you. The first week I was in Rockport, I saw corn growing out of the ground and goats and lighthouses. When I closed my eyes at night, I could still see those fireflies blinking. I couldn't get over the fireflies. It was the first time I ever slept in a bed by myself, and the sheets ironed. It felt like sleeping on silk. I got my own towel and a pillow that smelled like flowers. So many new smells. Beach roses, seaweed, smoke from a bonfire. I ate hot dogs and cherry pie and saltwater taffy that got stuck in my teeth. So you can imagine a city girl and for women in particular, you would live within 3 or 4 blocks of where you lived and you didn't go any farther. Your parents didn't want you to go any farther. They were afraid for you. And it was a very small life. So here she is, thanks to the Settlement House, where she has become involved in a club, a reading club, a book club, and these people change her life by helping her go to this place. During her first visit here, there's a lot of description of her very first time in Rockport Lodge. So everybody, she says, after lunch, which was interesting for her because they had pickles. This is funny, I thought. Nothing bad ever happened to me. Oh, this is only. So I ate everything they put in front of me at Rockport Lodge, except for the pickles. Who ever heard of a pickle that was sweet and soft? Feh. That's right. Anyway. Bread and butter pickles, I don't understand. Okay. After lunch, they sent everyone upstairs to put on shoes and hats to get ready for a hike. I didn't have a dictionary, so I asked Rose what a hike was. She said, hiking is the same thing as walking, only hotter and twice as far as you want to go. But usually you're glad you went. I didn't have a hat or another pair of shoes, so I just went to wait on the porch. The only chairs out there were made out of wooden twigs woven together. I couldn't believe something like that could be comfortable, which shows you what a greenhorn I was, all excited about a wicker chair. Rockport Lodge was on the road between Gloucester and Rockport, but I only saw one car pass by. It was so quiet, I could hear the bees buzzing around the roses and a bird singing from far away. Someone upstairs called out, "Has anyone seen my hairbrush?" In the kitchen, there was chopping. Every sound was separate, like framed pictures on a wall. I thought, aha, this is what you call peace and quiet. And if you know what the North End sounds like even today, there's not a lot of peace and quiet there. So the experience at Rockport Lodge opened Addie's eyes not only to Cape Ann, but also to Boston. When she came back to Boston, She looked up. She did go back down to the docks. She did look to the ocean. And she not only discovered the natural world, but she discovered a world outside of her own little tiny four-block neighborhood in the North End. I think I owe a similar debt to Cape Ann, which continues to inspire me to show me beauty and peace and quiet and open my heart and my imagination. I can't imagine what would have happened to me if my neighbors who took us up here had been Plum Island people. Or Ipswich people. Would I have written any of these books? Probably not. I'm just very glad I landed here. Thank you. So now we're doing questions and answers. Yeah, I'll repeat questions if it's a... Yeah, yes, I am.
This is going to sound stereotypical, and I don't want it to, but what is the Jewish connection?
What is the Jewish connection? Well, it's not in all of them. In this book, Addie's from a Jewish family, and in the North End at that time, it was actually quite... diverse in a way. It was Irish. There were Irish, Italians, and Jews all living together. It changed rather quickly. The North End had been home to waves of immigrants. In fact, Africans, freed Africans, lived in the North End for a short period of time in the 1800s. But it was a place immigrants landed. It was cheap. It was poor, and people then moved on from there. But for this period of time, it was a mixture, and mostly people stayed apart from each other. But at the settlement house that she was part of, and also at Rockport Lodge, they were intentionally mixed, these groups. And so it was not the norm for people from different backgrounds to make friends and hang out. But the people who ran Rockport Lodge were very proud of the fact that it did serve different groups of people. And actually, Addie talks about in her first time up here, that there's a table over there, all Italians over there, and those are the Irish girls, and there are the Jewish girls, but her table is mixed, and someone called them the mixed nuts. So they call themselves that. Nobody. So it wasn't all that typical, but it was in fact historically accurate.
Well, you write about her Jewish experience with great authenticity.
Well, I'm Jewish, and I'm the daughter of immigrants. And I did research on the period, so, and like many immigrants at that time, she was trying to become an American, as well as, and get out from under the thumb of very traditional parents. So that's a very common immigrant story in America from not just, I've gotten amazing emails from people from all different backgrounds. I got one from a woman in the Midwest, in Minnesota, saying it reminded her of her Scandinavian grandmother. It was like, okay. But the immigrant story of intergenerational conflict is kind of universal. Yeah.
I just have a question regarding Good Harbor, and Joyce is at Salt Island, and she's looking at, you refer to Atlantic Avenue?
Did I get it wrong?
Uh-huh.
Ugh. Atlantic Road, oh, sorry. But Joyce is new to the neighborhood.
Well done. Well done.
Joyce didn't know the neighborhood. I'm. Thank goodness, yeah, she's new. I mean, if Kathleen had said it, it would have really been wrong, because Kathleen would have known, because she lived here. Okay. Okay. Now I know. Thanks, I guess. Yeah.
I like the statue that Good Harbor that was in the lady's yard who was Jewish or converted to Judaism?
No, Joyce buys a house with that beautiful statue of the Madonna, and she's like three-quarter size, it's big. She doesn't want it there, but she wants to be respectful, so she takes she finds a priest to talk to, and there's a whole rigmarole about doing it the right way.
Yeah. I love that, because I grew up Catholic and had a lot of Jewish friends, and I mean the whole thing was very real, and plus living here, I can picture, you know, the priest
coming to
Being
that.
Being of assistance.
Yes. Well, I drive by that statue all the time, and I wave. I feel very proprietary, and I'm in horror. I hope nobody ever takes her down. And she's been whitewashed and painted over the years, so somebody's taking good care of her. So.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and then my family moved to Denver, Colorado when I was 12. So I kind of grew up in Denver, and junior high school, 2 years of college in Colorado, and then moved slowly east. And I've been in Massachusetts in the Boston area since 1975, so it's certainly my home. It's where I've lived most of my life. So I identify with it down here. Yeah, in the back.
I just want to ask about your writing process. Like, do you have a certain target of so many pages a day?
No, 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 five novels. The six nonfiction books, they're much easier to write than nonfiction. My writing process, it varies depending on where I am in the project. If I'm doing research, I'm doing research. If I'm writing, I'm also doing research. I do better in the morning after a lot of coffee and walking the dog. And I do a lot of walking. And I think when I'm really in it, I'm thinking about it when I'm washing the dishes and just doing just about anything, and I find it very difficult. I find writing very painful.
Yeah. We talked about the audiobook recording of The Boston Girl. If any of you have not read The Boston Girl, I would highly recommend the audio recording of that. And what is the woman?
Linda Lavin recorded it. Yeah, she's really good, and it's very warm
fabulous.
Voice. She's really good.
But you excellent. Did such an absolutely fabulous job of showing us who all of those people were. And I love how when she was growing up and she was like this young sort of innocent, but not really, she had some wisdom underlying all of the innocence. And the fact that she could see through a lot of the people that she met. And then finally when she met...
Aaron.
Yeah, she was, the way you described that relationship was, it was great. It was really great.
I didn't pay her, I promise.
Yeah, they had a great marriage.
They did. Yeah. And actually, that's the big triumph of the book, in fact, that she did not reproduce her parents' relationship, and the fact that she has a loving relationship with her she's the grandmother I hope I can be someday, right? Yeah, she has a really great relationship with her granddaughter, that they can actually talk to each other and joke, and so that's the triumph of the book,
yeah.
In a way. Okay, wait.
Yeah, I'm wondering, have you ever had a scrap some, ideas for a book?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm going to revisit.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
What was the question?
The question is if I ever scrapped an idea for a book. Yeah, and not just an idea, but I did work on something that I put aside. I may go back to it. I haven't decided. I'm going to look at it in January. Yeah.
Yeah, to what degree do you plot in advance?
To what degree do I plot in advance? Usually, and what has worked for me is I know where it ends. I don't necessarily know how I'm going to get there. So with The Red Tent, I knew she was going to die at the end. Oh, spoiler alert. Good Harbor, I wanted it to end at the end. It was like a summer. It was a summer-long project, and it was going to, not that the writing took a summer, but that it was going to start at the beginning of the summer and end at the end of a summer. So that was the finish line. So I that's worked for me. And then the plotting develops as I'm writing and rewriting.
The characters, as they take life, determines to some degree...
The characters really, it's all revising. So the more I revise, the better I know who the characters are. And then things do follow from that. But the plot also, the development of the plot and the development of the characters sort of go together hand in hand for me. Different for everybody. Anybody else? Yeah.
I wondered what you thought of the TV series of content, if they consulted you, things you liked and didn't like.
It's a question about the Lifetime TV version of The Red Tent. No, it had nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing. They don't want the writer attached. And as my mother, who recently passed away, said when she saw it, she said, "This is it. This is my comment. Their teeth were too white." It has a happy ending. Lifetime TV, she doesn't die at the end of the Lifetime TV. She literally rides off into the sunset. So it was, you know, it sold a lot of books. It's been shown in England. It's shown in Mexico. So it was fine. It's fine. It was like 16 years after the book was published that people had talked about getting the rights and making a film out of it, you know, and this one finally came through. And I have to say, the women who made it, who I met, they worked for a long time to get the funding and the okay from the network, and they hired the best people they could. They hired well-known actresses for this role. It was a big breakthrough for Lifetime. So I have a lot of respect for the women who put it together. It's not my book, but that's what happens when somebody else takes your story. But that's... I'm okay with it. It's a long time ago, too.
Yeah. I have to say, you've written the best description, the most inspiring description of kissing that I have ever read in Boston Girls.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What page is that?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I put a marker.
Oh! Yeah. What page is it?
Oh no, it was in Dogtown.
Oh, all right. That's I'm trying. Oh, this is Judy and Neil. Is that who is it? Judy and Neil or not?
In the last days of Dogtown. Yes, Cornelius taught her how to kiss.
Oh yeah. I'm not sure. Maybe I don't know if that. Are we going to get embarrassed? No, I'm not going to read that. You read it. It's very personal. It's one of the interesting things about writing historical fiction that I found, and that was really heartbreaking to me about that relationship and about writing about it, made it difficult, is that people didn't talk so much about their feelings. Right? We live in a very confessional time, and people disclose a lot. But in the past, people didn't talk about the past. They didn't talk about themselves. They didn't talk about what hurt them. They didn't talk about what gave them joy, even, for the most part. And that silence, to respect the silence and the fact that people did live with a lot of silence around their lives, is tough because you have to explain what happened to them, but by the same token, they can't be chatting about it. So Judy and Neil can't talk to each other about the fact that they are deeply in love with each other, and they can't acknowledge it. And until he's dead, actually, she can't really face the fact that that's what was going on. He's black and she's white, and that just doesn't happen. And they weren't married, and on and on. But that's true. That's true in any book that you place prior to the past 50 years or so. So I find that an interesting emotional landscape to write about.
But it's what was in her mind.
Mind, yes, was in her mind.
That's what was so special.
Oh. Yes, but she's not telling him, and he's not telling her. That's right. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Anyone else? One more. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
So when you are washing dishes and you think of something brilliant to write, do you have a notebook? Do you record?
Actually, when I'm thinking like that, it's usually there's a problem that I don't know where I've written myself into a corner. So that it's not really the words so much as it's like it's plotting rather than I have to be sitting in terms of language, but it's like, oh, she wouldn't do that, or I just have to go right over to here. So it's like getting out of that corner that happens. It's problem solving rather than writing. One last one and then we'll, yeah.
I just like the fact that the drug dealer in Good Harbor was at Rockport and not in Gloucester.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right. All right. All right. And of course, there's liquor. There's we got liquor off Eastern Point, which is a very fancy neighborhood in Boston Girls. So, we spread around the evil. So, yeah.
question.
Okay.
Did you ever read Boston Boy by Nat
Hentoff? Oh, Boston. No, long.
Read,
question? The question is, did I ever read Boston Boy by Nat Hentoff? I think I did many, many years ago. But that's a very different kind of book, and it was about being a Jewish boy growing up and getting beaten up by the Irish kids. There's a lot of that in the beginning.
There is.
There is
a lot of music.
And music, right. But it, you know, book titles, it's tough. Boston Girl, Boston Boy. Day After Night is a novel I wrote about Palestine in 1945, right after World War II, and it's called Day After Night. And so we had a lot of conversation about night by Elie Wiesel, mm-hmm. and all these words float around, and there's no way, there's nothing original in titling, I don't think, so. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming out and for supporting the Writers' Center. And I'm gonna sit over here and sign books.